nationwide youth mobilization plan for Friday. That's April 20th, and it's called Cover the Night. Kony 2012 Part 2 has not found as enormous an audience as the first film. Part 2 received about 1% of the views of its predecessor in its first week. In a moment, we will be joined by two Ugandans talking about this video and what it has meant in their country. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're talking about the most viral video in history, 100 million views in just 1 week. It's called Kony 2012. We're joined now by two Ugandans to talk about this film. Milton Alamadi is publisher and editor-in-chief of Black Star News, and Victor Ochin is a survivor of the LRA War and director of African Youth Initiative Network based in northern Uganda. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Victor, let us begin with you. You actually showed this film, Kony 2012, in northern Uganda.
Shortly after the movie was released, a lot of questions came in from northern Uganda. What do people think about? What are the victims' perspective in terms of, you know, the movie? And we had our own position, you know, position to give out what we thought it was, you know, about the movie, and realizing that northern Uganda is a place where not everybody has access to internet. Almost 0% of the victims have access to internet, no electricity, no television, and the movie was electronic and no one would access that. So getting to realize that we are talking about northern Uganda, a community that doesn't have access to all these things, that means they wouldn't completely be part of the global debate. So we decided that we are going to screen the movie across the region to the identified victim spots. And then we chose and started on the 13th of April. We screened it. The first screening was in Lira Town. And when we screened the movie, it was overwhelming. The turn up was amazing. Within few hours, when we advertised that we are going to screen the movie, we saw over 35,000 people walking, riding bicycles, women, men, children. Schools had to close in the afternoon so that people could come and watch the movie, because it was being debated all over the radio, but in a way which was quite misinforming, because the information was like, we hear Kony has been arrested in the year 2012. We hear Invisible Children has mobilized a lot of money to bring down to northern Uganda. And some were saying Invisible Children is an organization that is working out to arrest Kony. And people were not so sure about whether Kony has come back to Uganda, whether he was arrested, how the money was coming from Invisible Children to them. So we thought we give opportunity to the victims in the community to get to hear what the world is talking about and also give their views to the rest of the world. Yes, we did screen.
A lot of people have been critical of the film for many reasons, but one of the criticisms that features again and again is the alliance of Invisible Children with evangelical Christian groups in the U.S. And I want to go to a short clip from British journalist Charlie Brooker, who discussed the evangelical strains behind the Invisible Children campaign in a satire on the show 10 O'Clock Live. Here he talks about filmmaker Jason Russell.
In short, critics say Kony 2012 may have raised awareness but could do far more harm than good, which is a shame since the campaign seems so persuasive and even has a charismatic frontman, namely the director and co-star Jason Russell, who's been popping up everywhere over the past week like a clean-cut Abercrombie and Fitch version of Jesus Christ. He seems quite evangelical, possibly because he is. Look, here he is, telling students at an evangelical Christian college how to win people over to your cause without frightening them off by sounding overtly Christian.
The trick is to not go out into the world and say, I'm going to baptize you, I'm going to convict you, I have an agenda to win you over. Your agenda is to look into the eyes, as Jesus did, and said, who are you, and will you be my friend?
No, I won't.
Milton Alimadi, your comments on the evangelical strains, the alleged evangelical strains in Invisible Children.
I'm glad you showed that clip, because that's when he appeared, I think, at Liberty College or Liberty University. And in addition to that, he was making several flippant statements. He was saying, we can actually go out there and have fun while stopping genocide. And that kind of attitude is pervasive throughout the video. And that's one of the things that bothered me the most, because I was looking at it from a logical point of view. You're saying you want to go and help the victims of this violence, this war that's going on for 26 years. And what is your solution? You're inviting the involvement of more U.S. military assets as a solution. So that bothered me a lot. I found that preposterous logic. But at the same time, the video became very phenomenally popular because it shows that there's a huge segment of the global population that wants to do something to contribute to ending the atrocity that's gone on for far too long. The relationship between Invisible Children and the U.S. government and the Ugandan regime disturbed me a lot, and we started doing more investigation and more research, and that's how we came out with the revelation that the U.S. ambassador to Uganda in 2009 had actually written a cable, which was revealed through WikiLeaks in February 2009, indicating that Invisible Children had approached the U.S. embassy and made it known to them that they were going to be conducting campaigns that would advocate and promote the military solution. That was one of the memos. A second memo, which was actually much more disturbing, said that Invisible Children had provided a tip to Ugandan intelligence services leading to the arrest of a suspected regime opponent. This regime opponent used to be a child soldier as well, and had been taken under the care of Invisible Children, and was in fact staying at one of their facilities in Uganda. He was arrested, and as many people familiar with Uganda know, people that are arrested by intelligence services in Uganda are subjected to torture. Subsequent to his arrest, 9 other Ugandans were arrested, and now they face treason charges, and treason in Uganda is punishable by the death penalty. So the relationship between Invisible Children does not seem to be independent. It seems to be involved in line with the U.S. administration and the Ugandan regime in advocating and pushing the military solution as the only approach, and disregarding the voices of Ugandans such as Bishop Odama, Bishop Ochola, who come from the war-affected region, who've been pushing the resumption of a negotiated solution to this war.
There is clearly a greater U.S. military presence in Africa with AFRICOM. Obama is clearly pushing that, President Obama. Victor Ochen, the image we see in Kony 2012 is the Obama signing four advisors to go to Uganda. You have Jason Russell cheering and many people cheering, and then you see those images of the advisors and then Ugandan military as if they will save the day. Talk about the military in relation to the Lord's Resistance Army.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I know if the U.S. government knew whatever agreement, whatever signature they're going to put down was going to go against the innocent civilian, I think Barack Obama wouldn't have signed that into law. One thing is, every time you talk about the military intervention to LRA in northern Uganda, it's a most sensitive situation because we have like thousands of children, family members who are still in captivity. They're probably dead, but the family still feels they are going to come back alive. And then any campaign that looks for military intervention remains the most sensitive because families are looking for their relatives. When are they going to come back? What if Kony is defeated tomorrow and then this family member doesn't come back? What sort of preparation do we have in place? So, believing how Americans care about the rest of the world, about Uganda, about ending this suffering, this is a common commitment that everybody is saying, let's do whatever we can afford to make sure Kony is arrested. But what mechanisms do we have in place to protect the civilians, the children, the women? And also now, going ahead to make it a campaign strategy that we are telling Kony that you are going to end in 2012. Is it not a systematic early warning mechanisms being done to Kony by Invisible Children that you better take care. We are coming for you. We know you have been in the bush for long because you've been covering yourself with the children, with women. Now we are coming. We know where you are. We are coming for you. So it's too many victims, too many Ugandans, too many Africans, they feel this is a tactical, strategic early warning system by Invisible Children, a Latin coin, to take more cover and to become more violent.
Cover the night. This plan for Friday, for April 20th, where people all over the country will put up signs, perhaps around the world, that say Kony 2012. You say coin.
Yeah.
But just to be clear for people in the United States, referring to what people in the U.S. say in English, Kony.
Mm.
What does that poster, the T-shirts that all the young people are wearing, mean to you?
I speak as a victim, as someone whose brother was taken and he has never come back. But I don't want to play based on that. And I talk about myself. If I talk about myself alone, I lose the meaning. So a campaign like Cover the Night, the victims, when they saw the film, the most infuriating things was when they saw that make him famous. The first question, why do you want to make him famous? Is responsible for our suffering. The victims were pleading without hands, without legs, without ears, nose, and saying, if you really care about us, if you really understand what we feel, how we have suffered, you will respect our feeling. You will not put on the T-shirts that make coin famous. We don't need even any publicity about coin. The world knows about coin. United States government has been very instrumental in working with the government of Uganda in trying to end the coin rebellion. And then you go ahead to make it a point that you move around the world to tell the world that coin is existing. The more the victims gets empowered, the more coin becomes less relevant. And then the victims are appealing. They're saying, don't do that. Don't put on the T-shirt. Don't put on the promotional material. But Invisible Children remain completely adamant. And now, at this point, they care for the video more than they care for the people.
Milton Alimadi, some critics have pointed out, so far as the capture of Joseph Kony is concerned, that the indictment by the International Criminal Court actually serves as a disincentive and makes it almost certain that he will not give up. And what the Lord's Resistance Army was seeking was an amnesty, and that was ruled out.
Yes, that's the indictment does serve it as a disincentive. But I think that if a negotiated solution was proposed involving, let's say the United States took a serious interest and asked an individual like Jimmy Carter, for example, to be involved, and it was given the global visibility that it deserved, I think there could be a successful negotiated outcome. And everybody knows that members of the Security Council, including the United States, could do something about that existing indictment. It could be suspended. The key question here is there a serious will to end this conflict? Because look, the LRA is now in Central African Republic. We saw an article in the Washington Post 2 days ago saying they're committing atrocities in the Central African Republic, but the Ugandan army at the same time is also committing atrocities in the Central African Republic. And the U.S., by some great wisdom, is allied itself with the Ugandan regime.
But what are U.S. interests in Uganda? Why would the U.S.
Very good question. That's one of the things that's not been adequately discussed. Many skeptics believe that the U.S. has other interests. And what are these interests? It's no coincidence that major oil discoveries have been made in northern part of Uganda, in South Sudan, in parts of the Congo, and in the Central African Republic. And of course, the U.S. is concerned about China's penetration in that part of the region. China has significant interests based in Khartoum, but pushing toward the southern zone, the areas I described right now. And people believe that the U.S. basically wants boots on the ground, because if anybody sees that article in the Washington Post, they're really not doing anything to go after Joseph Kony anyway.
We just have 30 seconds. Victor Ochin, Museveni has been in power for 26 years. Kony's been operating all that time. If Kony is gone, Museveni perhaps doesn't get that level of support to fight Kony. Does Museveni need Kony?
At this point, I wouldn't say Museveni needs Kony. Kony, looking at his intentions, looking at his principles, his operation, I think it's just a cult organization focused at killing the innocent civilian. Coin doesn't have any particular political agenda, which is clear. And that's why they end up causing all these atrocities on the innocent people who know nothing to do with politics. If he needed Kony, if he needed Museveni, he would have gone to Kampala to fight Museveni. But why does he end up fighting the children, the women who know nothing to do with politics?
We're going to leave it there. We thank you very much for being with us. Victor Ochen is a survivor of the LRA war, director of the African Youth Initiative Network in northern Uganda. And thank you very much to Milton Alamadi, publisher and editor-in-chief of Black Star News. That does it for the show. DemocracyNow.org is our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
As interesting as listening to this PSA is, there's nothing quite like watching it. Watching what, you ask? The annual showcase of films that accompany it as part of the POV, or Persistence of Vision Film Festival. This showcase of short films written, directed, shot, edited, and produced by students in the film production program at UBC happens only once a year. On April 27th and 28th, join the POV Festival at the Empire Granville 7 Cinemas in the heart of downtown Vancouver as these magnificent films are debuted. For tickets and information, visit POVfilmfestival.com.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
Whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electropop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds fit, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Clownsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Clownsville, and we're
making... You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
This April at the Rio, Open Mic Nights will now be happening twice monthly. A showcase of local musicians, comedians, poets, and variety acts. Doors at 7 p.m. and the show starts at 8 for these free 19-plus events, April 4th and 18th. Want more live entertainment? Check out Dirty Dancing Burlesque at the Rio April 5th, a burlesque show featuring live music with all the hit songs from the Dirty Dancing soundtrack and burlesque inspired by the movie. Saturday, April 7th. Back by popular demand, it's the Big Screen Barrel House 2, a modern throwback to the silent film era. Film classics will have their soundtracks reimagined by some of Vancouver's most talented acts. Wednesday, April 11th, it's Canada's own classical pianist and DJing wonder kid, Chili Gonzalez. Get your advance tickets through the Rio website today or at Red Cat, High Life, and Zulu Records. Wondering what to do on 420? For only a toonie, come out to the Champion of Champions variety show. The audience will determine a first place $500 and a second place $150 winner and will get the chance to win some swell swag for themselves. For more information on all this and more, check out theriotheatre.ca.
Welcome to the Extra Environmentalist.
Your opposable thumb
means nothing.
This is what we want to be. We don't want to be Americans or Germans or English. We want to be extra environmentalists. Always feel wherever you go that you are a stranger. The outsider, the one looking in. This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
And welcome. Wait. I'm gonna start this again.
Hello and welcome to the Extra Environmentalist. I'm your host, Seth Moser-Katz, along with my co-host, Justin Ritchie. And today we have a very, very special guest, Stephen Keane, who is an economist.
Hold on, Seth. Why are you talking that way?
I don't know. I was thinking about trying to get a job with the BBC. What do you think of my BBC voice?
I think it sounds terrible, actually. That's not what people on the BBC sound like.
Oh, yeah, you know, it's okay.
It sounds like an American trying to pretend that they're on the BBC radio.
Actually. Really?
Yeah.
Really? Well,
It's another career opportunity just lost to me.
Yes, but that doesn't mean that we're not talking with Steve Keen today. Steve Keen is an economist, a professor, and one of the few people who are practicing economists who actually forecasted the economic crisis that the world is now experiencing. And so that's why we're really excited to talk to him today about his book, Debunking Economics, which was released in its second edition. It is a fascinating look at why the way that economics is practiced, mainly in the policy realm, through the way it's taught in many economics departments, is completely out of touch with the way the world actually works. But a lot of the critiques that I've read about economics focuses on how they don't necessarily follow up with physical reality and don't follow the second law of thermodynamics. But this one's interesting because it actually uses the theories of economics and goes back through the history of the profession and looks at the ways that people who are actually upheld and honored by economists debunked their own theories later in their life. So it's just that the critiques that Steve Keen brings forward, a lot of them were actually put forward by economists who founded the field of modern economics as we know it today. It's just modern economics found ways to politely ignore all of the things that they found.
Yeah, economics and economists are pretty good at ignoring a lot of inconsistencies in a lot of different things, you know, in the market, in their theories themselves. And they just kind of wait for that invisible hand just to come up out of nowhere and make things right. Don't they, Justin?
Yes. Well, with that being said, I'm going to use my visible hand to get this interview started.
Thank God.
Yeah, so we'll jump right in. Steve Keen, you're a professor at the University of Western Sydney and author of the book Debunking Economics. And thanks for joining us from Sydney, Australia today to talk about retooling economics education and general problems with economic thought in the world today.
That's my barrow, for sure. Good to be talking with you.
So, Steve, what allowed you to foresee these current global financial crises all the way back in 2005? You have written about these things extensively.
If I go right back, it's because I broke away from neoclassical economics right back in 1971 when I was an undergraduate student. That's a general background, but of course many people do that. Most of them then drop out of economics, but a handful go and become academic economists like myself. And I'd say probably about 15% of the academic profession worldwide would be reject the dominant school of thought called neoclassical economics. So that's the general rubric I come from. The reason I specifically saw the crisis coming is I specialized in the work of Hyman Minsky. That puts me in a smaller band again, but a lot of post-Keynesian economists in particular influenced by Minsky. The different thing I did was I tried to put Minsky in a mathematical framework by using ideas from complexity theory. And out of that work, first of all, I saw the importance of the level of private debt compared to GDP, which is one of the key indicators that Minsky himself focuses upon as a sign of a financial bubble and therefore a potential financial crisis after it bursts. But I also, working in complexity theory, I built nonlinear dynamic models of Minsky's thesis. And one of the characteristics they had was a period of apparent stability would occur in key economic indicators from a neoclassical point of view, basically rate of inflation and the level of employment. But in the background, there'd be a rising level of debt to GDP. Out of that tranquility, it finally we'd pass into a period of increasing volatility and finally a breakdown. So that was my expectations of what could happen. I checked the data back in 2005, getting ready to write a book on the topic and also doing an expert witness case for a group suing a predatory lender. And I then saw the debt to GDP ratio as literally growing exponentially. And I thought, holy hell, this, you know, it was huge as well. Certainly the biggest it had been in the previous 40 years, given the data I had at the time. And I thought, this has to turn around. When it does turn around, it'll be the biggest crisis, certainly in the last 40 years. Somebody has to raise the alarm, and at least in Australia, I'm that somebody. The basic punchline was focusing on the level of private debt compared to income and GDP and seeing that hitting an exponential trend, which had to break. And when it did, we'd be in the biggest crisis since the Great Depression.
Why didn't other people see this coming and question the rate of debt accumulation in the economy? And then also, if you could explain what you mean when you're talking about neoclassical economics, just in case some of our listeners aren't familiar with that term.
Yeah, sure. Well, starting from that end, the neoclassical economists are what most people think is economics. So people who talk about supply and demand and equilibrium this and equilibrium that, they are, and the ones you hear mainly on the media, they are neoclassical economists. That's whether they know they are or they're not, because it's taught in such a way in most universities that people don't actually leave without actually even realizing there are alternative ways to think about how the economy operates. And they see the economy as fundamentally a system of barter between independent producers who produce a commodity they have in excess of, they want to trade that for ones they have a deficiency of, and the market economy is a way of linking these people together. And money is just, from that point of view, just an intermediary. Money is unimportant. And they also not only ignore money, they also ignore the existence and role of banks. Believe it or not, for the people who haven't heard a person talking about economics before, that is the dominant strand, and virtually every Nobel Prize winner, including people like Paul Krugman and most recently Thomas Sargent, come from that background. So they model the economy with mathematical models that presume the economy always tends towards equilibrium and doesn't need money and doesn't have banks in it. Now, of course, if you don't believe the system needs money and you don't believe banks matter, you're not even going to see a financial crisis coming. You're going to ignore the financial sector, which is fundamentally what they did. So when the financial crisis hit, the economists from that background, and that's really 85 to 90% of the profession, had no idea this was coming. So they were completely blindsided by an a priori argument that the level of money doesn't matter, what banks do in the economy doesn't matter. That rules out, as I said, 90% of the profession. With the remaining 10%, quite a few of those people would have been aware of a crisis coming because alternative approaches to economics, so like those that emanate from the Austrian School of Economics with Mises and Hayek and Rothbard being prominent thinkers there, one extreme, and then on the other extreme, people who call themselves post-Keynesian, who've argued that Keynes was misinterpreted by conventional economists, and they therefore reject, for example, Krugman's right to call himself a Keynesian in a genuine sense. They call themselves post-Keynesians. They also focus on money because Keynes said money was important. They didn't quite work out how to model that technically. Then apart from that, even Marxists also focus on the level of financial speculation. So the 10% that's not mainstream would have people who would have been potentially worried about it. I'd say probably about a quarter of those, so say 2.5% of the profession, was seriously worried about the crisis. That then comes out to the minority who then stick their neck up and say, hey, in the public, not just in the academic circles, I think something really bad is happening. But then a tiny fraction of those have got the gall, the balls, whatever, to stick their neck out in public and say, I expect a crisis to come. And there was about 100 people who did that. And you're looking at the various surveys that have been done. I ended up being, in terms of the academic, one of the most prominent. But people like, of course, publicly, the most well-known person to raise a warning was Nouriel Roubini. Then you also had Glenn Baker at the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, Anne Pettifors over in England, who wrote a book on debt back in 2000, led the Debt Jubilee campaign back then. So there's a range of people who did. What they had in common, even though they came from very different schools of thought, one, for example, being Peter Schiff, who's very Austrian in his thinking, we all focused on the level of private debt. So you had the majority ignoring private debt. That's the mainstream neoclassicals. 10% accepting private debt's important, but in various ways. So say 2.5% of the profession doing that. And then a handful, something like about 100, who started raising the warning, and about a dozen who were particularly prominent. And I'm one of that dozen.
So outside of the economics profession, we've been in this financial crisis for a few years now. And I'm wondering if you are starting to see in the general public more of an awareness of the role of personal debt in the unsustainability of our current financial system.
Oh, yeah. And individuals, if you're in debt and you've taken out a debt because you basically expected to make a gain on rising house prices, then you're probably in America, you're massively in debt right now. And the first thing you think about when you wake up in the morning and before you go to sleep at night, the level of personal debt you're in and how can you reduce it? At a very visceral and personal level, the public knows private debt matters. In terms of how they consider the economy and how it's analyzed, I think I can sense a growing level of exasperation when you hear public pronouncements by people like Bernanke and also Krugman saying the level of debt doesn't matter, private debt. They obsess about public debt. They actually try to assure people that the level of private debt has no macroeconomic impact. They're still arguing that even after the crisis occurred and after private debt started to fall, they don't even take the coincidence seriously that, you know, we've gone from a boom to a bust, and that's coincided with rising and then falling private debts. They still haven't gelled on that, even that empirical fact. The level of exasperation about economists is rising, and I'm seeing more and more negative jokes about economists and so on, all of which I'm totally in favour of.
What's your favourite economist joke?
Oh, it was actually one that ended up having our treasurer in Australia at the time, a guy called John Kieran, a lovely, socially progressive, very warm human being, as a prisoner of war survivor in the Second World War, and just a lovely human being all round. And he was made treasurer for a short while, and he made the mistake of telling a joke to the assembled economists in Treasury that meant they were out to get rid of him, which they finally did. But he said, "What is the definition of waste?" The definition of waste was a bus full of economists going over a cliff with one empty seat.
That's pretty funny. So you've talked a little bit about all these historical examples of you kind of being part of a group that has forecasted this crash. Could you talk a little bit about some of the historical examples that you've found of financial crises in the past? And then maybe also you can work that into what's actually happening right now in Europe, a mile up view, so people who don't really know can kind of get a grasp of what's happening.
Well, I'll start from the basic. We've had an approach to economics which ignores money, and that's madness. So I'm trying to develop an approach which takes money seriously. And if you ignore money, you'll argue that aggregate demand, the total spending, what spending people can spend, is aggregate supply. You only get a chance to buy if you sell something beforehand. That's the conventional way of thinking. But if you live in a credit-based economy, which we do, of course, aggregate demand is not just your capacity to demand goods and services is not just limited to your income. You can also go and max out your credit card. And because the credit system can expand, so you can get additional debt being created without taking money off savers, total demand in the economy is the sum not just of income, it's income plus the change in debt. So that's the bottom line. That's the core argument that I'm trying to get into economics that lets us understand where these crises come from. So the change in private debt adds to aggregate demand, and it gets spent buying goods and services, paying for investment, but also paying for speculation on rising asset prices. And that's why these bubbles always both form and collapse. If you go back to the 1920s, the last great big bubble and boom we had, the level of private debt in America went from about 100 to 175% of GDP over that decade. And then asset prices crashed, as you know, the Wall Street crash. People stopped borrowing money to try to gamble on rising asset prices, and therefore they started to reduce their debt levels. And you had a period of falling debt. But also, because firms were mainly in debt back in those days, firms were cutting their prices to try to get customers in through their doors. So you had not just falling debt levels, you also had falling prices and falling output. And the output and prices fell faster than debt did. So the debt ratio actually rose from 175% of GDP to 235% in the first couple of years of the crisis. And then we had the Great Depression. I don't need to remind people too much about how horrific that experience was. So we've gone through exactly the same process again this time round, only with a higher level of debt. So back in 1945, after the Second World War, the level of private debt in America was roughly 45% of GDP. It grew over the next 30 years to hitting about back to the same level as before the Great Depression, about 1987 with the stock market crash then. But then with the rescues that Greenspan and friends put in, the financial sector survived each of those crashes and continued lending money until you got to the stage at the peak of the crisis when the level of private debt in America was 300% of GDP. That was in roughly in 2009. It's since then been paid down to 250%. So what we've now got is, because aggregate demand is the sum of GDP plus the change in debt, all the way through from 1945 to 2008 roughly, aggregate demand exceeded incomes because debt was rising. Since 2008, aggregate demand has been below income because people are using the excess to pay their debt down. And that's why you're in an extended slump. And until such time as people have reduced their debt levels drastically from the current levels now of about, in America's case, 250% of GDP down to about 100% or below, you're going to have the tendency for demand in the economy to be less than the incomes being generated in the economy, and therefore you'll have declining demand and a continued slump. But that's where we are right now. It's crystal clear. It's very simple to understand when you look at the role of change in debt. If you don't, it's completely perplexing. And that's why people like Bernanke and Krugman still can't understand why the crisis is continuing.
That's the exact dynamic that's playing out right now in Europe, in the European financial crisis?
That's actually, it's even worse, because the Europeans were even more insane than the Americans, because they designed their financial system around neoclassical economic theory. So what's called the Maastricht Treaty wrote into the actual limitations on what the governments of Europe could do, the theoretical perspective of neoclassical economics. And that theoretical perspective, first of all, said that fiscal policy was a bad thing and that monetary policy should be in the hands of experts, not in the hands of politicians. And on top of that, when they formed a single currency, they also effectively told the countries of Europe that they couldn't compete with each other by adjusting their exchange rates. That meant you locked Germany and Greece into exactly the same exchange rate. If there was a trade imbalance between the two countries, Greece couldn't respond to it by devaluing the euro, because it was the euro, it wasn't the drachma. So that locked them out of exchange rate policy. Then the rules of the Maastricht Treaty said a government couldn't run a deficit of more than 3% of GDP and couldn't accumulate a deficit of more than 60%. Now, that's pretty much saying government's deficits are always and everywhere a bad thing. And if you have a downturn in the economy, the government deficit necessarily rises because tax revenue falls and welfare payments rise. The Maastricht Treaty effectively said when that means your deficit exceeds 3% of GDP, you've got to cut spending. But rather than increasing spending when there's a downturn, or the gap rising and the deficit rising, you've got to actively reduce your spending at the same time as the economy is going down.
So what you're saying is austerity was built in from the beginning.
Yeah, it was built into the Maastricht Treaty from the beginning. And so when I read the first edition of Debunking Economics back in 2000, I made the remark there, which I've now quoted, of course, in the second edition, that the Maastricht Treaty will guarantee that when a crisis hits the European economies, economies which will be desperately in need of a government stimulus will then instead be forced into austerity. So it was predictable a decade ago that this would end in tears.
Is there any positive aspects of forming this union? Why would countries like Greece and Spain agree to give up their currencies and join these other countries in the European Union?
Mainly because it promised being part of a very large market. And when the appeal is always that if you get to a larger market, you can get economies of scale for what you're producing, export more of your gear overseas, and everybody's supposed to benefit. That's the basic mythology and methodology of trade unions, which are trying to basically reduce barriers between trading countries in the belief that the larger scale will result in gains for everybody. There's a minor amount of truth to it, but a major amount of fallacy as well. That fallacy is so complicated that I didn't even address it in Debunking Economics. It had taken an entire book to go through why the theory of trade, conventional theory of trade, is a load of nonsense. But that is what seduced politicians as well as economists, the belief that the larger market would mean an increase in welfare for all. And there's also been a strong desire, given Europe's very troubled political history, to bring about some form of union that means they work together rather than fighting each other. So there are reasons that go beyond the economic as to why they join together.
So historically, Greece would have devalued their currency, and now they are tied to this greater European currency that they can't devalue. And so it looks like the only option forward is debt haircuts or default. And it looks like every single day Greece gets closer and closer to default. And it's been this way for about a year now, where they're getting closer and closer to default. And then, last minute, it looks like they're going to get bailout money. And who knows how much longer it's going to go on. But what would a Greek default actually look like? How do you think something like that would play out?
Well, that's just one thing to clarify. The Greeks aren't getting this money. The banks that lent to the Greeks are getting the money.
Ah.
Okay. They say that Greece has to have this money by X date. Well, it's got to have money by X date, because the next date it's got to pay Bank Y the money that that's signed up in the debt contracts. So when they talk about giving Greece the money, it's giving the banks that lent to Greece the money. The Greeks don't get to see the money at all.
And an additional point of clarification, what does it mean that so many deposit outflows are occurring from Greek banks? Because people of Greece are just pulling their money from the banking system at, it seems like, an incredible rate. And what does that to the country's banking system?
You've got a rule which is forcing Greeks to implode, forcing the economy to implode. The only sensible thing you'd do if you had money in Greece is get it out of there and put it in another currency's bank. So you've got the government taxation being used to pay back the creditors, which is taking money massively out of circulation in Greece. You've got the austerity measures as well, reducing the amount of money in circulation. You've got cutting wages, reducing the amount of money in circulation there. Anybody with half a brain in Greece and any capacity to, you know, transfer money from one country to another will get their money out of there, giving you another reason. So what you've got is a absolutely accelerated economic collapse in the belief that economic collapse will make it easier to repay your debts. I mean, it just takes my breath away. This is the sort of thinking that's going on. But this is, again, classic neoclassical thinking. One reason that neoclassical economics appeals to people when they first hear it is it seems to make sense at the individual level. So if you've got a debt that's too much for you to handle on your current consumption level, what you do is you stop consuming, you reduce your consumption rate. Cool, that works fine because you don't get sacked because you're not consuming anymore. But if you do it collectively and everybody around you stops consuming, you get sacked because somebody else stopped consuming and your income goes down. And you actually have a self-defeating process at the aggregate level. And that's what's actually Greece is being forced into here, self-defeating behavior. What you really want to do is reduce the debt directly. You don't want to do it by trying to reduce the rate of turnover of your economy, which will reduce your income while leaving the outstanding debt at the same level.
And what do the policymakers at the EU really think is going to be the outcome? I mean, there's no way of exactly knowing, but using their philosophy of neoclassical economics, they must have been thinking that they're directing Greece to an outcome that will help to either preserve the union or help the EU. What do you think they were expecting all along to happen in this scenario?
Well, the dominant model in economic neoclassical economics right now is called dynamic stochastic general equilibrium, DSGE. That's a really fancy name for an absolutely terribly small, tiny, and mad model. The mad model imagines the entire economy as a single consumer who owns a single firm, the new economy, producing a single commodity, works in the firm, and decides how much to produce based on their rational expectations about the future cost of the economy, where they know the future accurately. No, I'm not joking. You can actually find Robert Solow, who's a Nobel Prize winner in neoclassical economics, absolutely stunned that anybody could take this model seriously. And when he made a description similar to the one that I've used and then finished with the punchline, I remember vividly, how could anyone expect a sensible short to medium term macroeconomic model to come out of that setup? Nonetheless, that's the mindset they have. So in that model, what they think happens if you have government taxation, they say government taxation now, expectations of if a deficit occurs now, that leads the rational agent to expect that there'll be a future increase in tax payments. Therefore, that person will spend less now because of the government deficit. Conversely, they argue that the government runs a surplus, that person will therefore expect to have a drop in future tax charges on them, and they will therefore spend more. So they call this particular notion expansionary fiscal consolidation. And they actually believe that by the government running a surplus, private spending will rise. That's the model they've got.
Sounds kind of backwards.
Backwards, a compliment. Retarded is closer to it. That's the thinking they have. And I first heard this being argued when I spoke at a commercial conference some time ago when there's an American economist out there, and he started talking about reverse Ricardian equivalence. Now, I knew what they meant by Ricardian equivalence. I hadn't heard this particular twist before, so I went and took a look at it. That was such a complicated term, they couldn't swing that even with policy advisors. Imagine a politician coming out saying, we know that through reverse Ricardian equivalence, this policy will work. So instead, they called it expansionary fiscal consolidation, which is about as almost as moronic, but not quite as, you know, impossible to sell to the public. So that's what they actually think is going to happen. Cut government spending, run a surplus, and the private sector will spend more and the economy will boom. Now, of course, that's completely ignoring the role of debt. And if you cut government spending, you take money out of the system, you slow down the rate of economic activity. Economic activity will fall and people will lose their jobs. Their income will go down more than they manage to save, and you'll have a higher debt crisis in the aftermath.
It sounds to me like this is a problem that seems to crop up a lot on this show. It happens in government. It happens in economics. People have a really, really hard time thinking 5 years in advance, 10 years in advance. Down the road, it's really tough. It's right now, it's political campaign season in the United States. And if you ask a political campaigner, say like a Mitt Romney or one of these guys up here, what's going on in Greece, what's going on in Europe, they're going to say this is the result of social programs gone awry. The Greek citizen just needs to buckle down, work harder. Is this the fault of Greek citizens? Is the fault of people in Europe, or is this something larger?
Oh, something larger. I mean, again, your general point about being able to think down the track is very true. I actually put it differently. I'm sure you'll have sympathy for this. People can't think systemically. It's very simple for people to think in a very straightforward X causes Y way of thinking. What they can't handle is X causes changes in Y, which causes a feedback effect on X. Really, what are dominating human society right now, both ecologically and economically. And the inability to think how the feedback will apply is what makes us take short-term explanations for crises and then look for very, very simplistic explanations, which in fact turn out to be empirically false, but because they appeal to the short-term perspective, people accept them as true. So, for example, the example of Greece, a recent study, I think by The Economist magazine, worked out that the workers who work the longest hours in Europe, wait for it, the Greeks. The workers who work the shortest number of hours in Europe, wait for it, the Germans. And the Germans have better holidays, et cetera, et cetera. There's certainly areas where the social security system in Greece is too generous compared to the productivity of the country. But on these all these various comparisons where people expect, you know, Germany to be at the top of a list and Greece to be the bottom, it's actually the other way around. And what really reflects is not the how hard the Greeks are working, but the caliber of the industrial technology they work with and the degree of innovation inside the society. And you've got the German economy, which has always been an innovative economy, massively industrialized, high-quality technology and so on, specialized in that to compete with Asia. And the Greeks are relying upon tourism and agriculture. So it's built in that they couldn't compete with the Germans, and they actually work harder than the Germans. There are more self-employed people in Greece than there are in Germany, et cetera, et cetera. So that short-term way of thinking doesn't stack up against the facts. And the problem I think we have in humanity in general is this inability to think in a system sense, which is why I regard the work of people like Forrester and Meadows and so on as so important. But I think we'll only learn about the necessity to think in a systemic sense after we've been through several really huge systemic crises, of which this financial crisis is only the first.
We've had the theories behind neoclassical economics for quite a few decades now. And after World War II, why haven't we had another Great Depression like we did in the late 20s and 30s? And why are we only just now getting to one?
Great question. That's actually the one that Minsky himself posed back in 1982. And he said, there's his book of essays, which I highly recommend people to read. It's a very readable book. And if you only manage to read one of the essays in there, you'll learn far more about economics than trying to slog through any textbook on the subject. And he had the title of the essay series, the set of essays, is called Can It Happen Again? The pivotal essay says, you know, can it happen again, meaning a Great Depression? And if it can happen, why hasn't it happened since 1945, when he's writing in 1982? So there had to be something about the institutional arrangements post the Second World War and the economic circumstances that explain why it didn't happen. Now, the reason, obviously it can happen again, because I think we really are in a depression. It's a joke to call this a recession. And secondly, the reason it didn't happen beforehand is because after the crisis of the 1930s and 40s, the level of private debt in America was driven down from its peak level of 235% of GDP down to 45% of GDP by the end of the Second World War. So you began with an incredibly low level of debt, probably actually lower than America needs in a sustainable sense. And the financial sector had a debt-to-GDP ratio of a mere 2%. So you had business debt, I'm only guessing here, proportion, but business debt would have been roughly 30% of GDP, household debt would have been something like 12% of GDP, and finance sector debt was about 2% of GDP. So you had very little debt. Paying the credit card was no problem, didn't exist, of course, but paying your debts was quite straightforward, and all the profits earned by American industry could go towards industrial development and the great technological advances of the 50s and 60s. But because you could still gamble in rising asset prices, that's something that hadn't been banned by the Glass-Steagall Act, people got into share market speculation. We then had a series of share market bubbles and bursts. The first big burst actually was in 1966. Most people don't realize that, but that was the first big stock market bubble and burst. Then a decline until 82, still with rising debt levels. So by the time we got to about 1982, I think from memory, I'm not looking at my data right now, but I think the debt ratio had cracked through 100% by then. By the end of 1988, it hit almost 170% of debt as GDP. And then we had the financial crisis of 1987 with the stock market falling 20% in one day. Alan Greenspan dives to the rescue. The financial sector that should have failed at the time, or financial institutions that should have failed, rescued and didn't go under. So they went looking for somebody else to lend the money to. Then we had the savings and loans fiasco. That collapses into the recession of the 1990s. they get rescued out of that again. Now, Bill Black did a lot of good job in prosecuting some of those people and putting them behind bars. Then you had the growth of long-term capital management type behavior, the growth of the hedge funds, debt levels now cracking 200% of GDP. Then you had the stock market, the bubble of the dot-com, the collapse of the dot-com, another rescue comes in, the financial market looked for somebody else to lend to, the really lending to the household sector at that stage, household lending takes off, the subprime, you crack 300% of GDP, then you have a crisis because you simply couldn't find, there's no way to rescue out of that situation, and there was nobody less to lend to because the entire American economy was saturated with debt. To give you rough figures at the time, household debt had gone from something that would have 10 to 15% of GDP back in 1945 to about 100% of GDP. Business sector debt had gone from something in the order of 30% to 70%, which though that's less than they had back in the Great Depression. Financial sector debt had gone from 2% to 120% of GDP. Now, if the financial sector itself is that much in debt, if the household sector owes four times as much as it did during the Great Depression and six times as much as it did back in the 1940s, and the business sector is carrying as much debt as in the middle of the 1920s, there's nobody else to lend to. So the whole house of cards finally fell over when we reached that point of no return.
So the reason this can't go on like the financial crises of, say, 1982 or other stock market crashes is because banks cannot find anyone else who can take on additional debt.
Fundamentally, yeah. The only reason people take on excessive debt is because they expect to make a profit out of rising asset markets. So they take a leveraged position. And I give a bit of an analogy here, which it seems to get through to people. Imagine going to the dentist with a sore tooth. You're only going to get that one sore tooth pull. Getting a tooth pull is not a pleasant experience. Going to the dentist is not a pleasant experience. What did the dentist persuade you? You look sexy with less teeth rather than getting the one rotten pull. Well, yeah, sexy with less teeth. Don't you look great? The girls will love you. well, that's similar to debt because banks say, look, debt's really ugly. Debt's awful. You don't like being in debt. You've got to pay somebody else before you can pay the bills. But debt can be good if you borrow the money, buy an asset, and if the asset goes up by 10% in value, you double your money. So leverage is good. And that's what persuades us to take on more debt than is sustainable. You can get a very easy comparison of this if you look at the level of household debt and break it down into personal debt, which is mainly directed at consumption, and mortgage debt, which is directed, of course, at buying houses. Now, that could be houses to live in, but of course it became houses to flip that house and make a profit out of. Well, back in 1990, I think the level of mortgage debt to GDP in America was about 40% of GDP, and personal debt was about 10%. Fast forward to 2008 or so, and personal debt was still about 10% of GDP, but mortgage debt had doubled because people thought they'd make a gain out of, you know, the flip that house mentality.
So is it more because we've run out of markets to saturate with debt? Are we just looking for the next market to saturate? Do we need to go out into space and find aliens to lend money to? Is that what we're looking for? Would that get us out of this problem?
That's the best reason for a moonshot, and going to maybe we'll find somebody on the moon we can lend money to. They've run out of potential lending targets in the rest of the world. You know, lending money is a two-sided activity. The banks have to be willing to lend, but they have to be willing borrowers as well. As I said, borrowers only take on money relative to income at a responsible scale. They become irresponsible and able to fall for the line that borrowing money is a good thing when they see asset price growth. So it isn't just that you run out of people to lend to. It's also you should drive asset prices to such a level that people finally just don't think it's even feasible to enter into the market. So that happened with both stock market prices and house prices. And then, of course, when you get them driven to the levels they were driven to, and the bubbles in the stock market